This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
So, did you hear the one about the public radio program that did an episode about the history of humor? Okay, that probably qualifies as the least funny way to introduce this episode. Week after week, we bring you stories and conversation with some of the greatest minds we can find. But sometimes, even the most stoic professor has got to bring the funny.
In a classroom, just like a stand-up comic, a joke can detox a situation or make a situation clearer.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the importance of being funny, or at least trying. And we'll spend an academic minute learning how being an early bird or a night owl can affect the way you make decisions. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The great American writer E.B. White once said, "Analyzing humor is like dissecting a frog. Few people are interested, and the frog dies." But Al Jeaney is giving it a try anyway. For Jeaney, humor is more than just foolish fun. It serves as a safety valve for dealing with reality that gives us the courage to endure that which we cannot understand or avoid. Al Jeaney is a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University in Chicago. For over 27 years, he was the resident philosopher on NPR's Chicago affiliate WBEZ and can currently be heard on WGN Tribune Radio. His newest book is called The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. I spoke to Al Jeaney about the importance of being funny and how a philosopher became interested in examining the funny.
I think that's a great question, asking what does philosophy have to do with humor, because I think philosophy and humor, although not directly connected in their origin, deal with the same issues. That is, philosophy asks difficult questions about life, and humor asks and makes fun of and points to difficult questions about life. One tries to come up with an absolute answer and doesn't always do so, philosophy. Humor doesn't really try to come up with an absolute answer, but gives it a moment for a pause, gives us a moment for reflection, and perhaps in that moment find another answer in another way.
Humorists, jesters, have been around forever. In fact, you put in the book how court jesters were the only ones who could really speak truth to power if they did it in a funny way.
Yeah, this has been, I think, a fabulous and fascinating cultural constant, not just in Europe, where we know of the medieval courts and Henry VIII's famous jester and so on and so forth, but throughout China, throughout India, in Japan, the Cheyenne American indigenous people, that this has been part of many, many different cultures. And it's been a safety valve, I think. I'm not sure exactly how it grew up, but it became a safety valve. The jester, the clown, in Cheyenne, the contrarian, could speak truth to power, but only within the guise of that role, not just get up and say something. Maybe had to have the funny stick and wear the funny hat and so on and so forth. But it's always been a release. And by the way, I think exactly what our jesters, our satirists do now to us in an entirely different way than they did from my parents. That is, before World War II and after World War II, I think right up to when George Carlin took off his tuxedo and started using his seven deadly words in public on a regular basis, I think there's been a division in comedy, and I think contemporary comics, for the most part, but not all of them, are really public court jesters.
It's funny you bring up Carlin, because one of his routines was the old court jester, you know, occupation fool. I remember that yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah, occupation fool. But think about this now. Without any reference to the president's political positions, et cetera, Donald Trump, good, bad, or indifferent, is just a lightning rod for satirical analysis, for comic analysis. I mean, his demeanor, his hair alone, the way he expresses himself. I mean, he is just a joke teller's dream. And in fact, Jon Stewart suggested that he announced his retirement a year before he left The Daily Show. He said, "What am I thinking? You know, Trump's going to run. I would have materials forever and ever." And then he did come on the scene, and point of fact, now at night, think about this, 5 major television shows are all Trump or all political news all night, and sometimes very vicious. But the reality is the older guys, Johnny Carson, Letterman, Leno, so on and so forth, they did political comedy, but that was not their whole stick. These guys are doing total political comedy. Not just these guys, Samantha Bee as well.
back then, it was kind of limited. They didn't go, quote unquote, too far with their
right.
jokes.
Right.
Now it seems to the pendulum has gone one way all the way, but there's an awful lot of blowback if you go too far now.
Yeah. You know, again, I think our comics, our satirists, are our court jesters, and we give them license to push the envelope. But there are limits to the license, and sometimes those limits fluctuate. For example, Amy Schumer now getting up at a comic review, and I've seen her do it in front of 50,000 fans and in front of 10,000 fans, tell us everything about the peculiar aspects of her anatomy and her sexual desires, okay? So she could push that. But I think when Kathy Griffin held up Mr. Trump's head and tried to make a joke out of that, that was a bridge too far. I think it's probably, if not destroyed her career, limited her career in the future. I think we want comics to reflect on and make fun of things we always can't do, but I think there are limits. And sometimes it's just good taste. Sometimes the simple rule is, do you really tell your mother a really naughty sexual joke? The answer is no. And so I think you would, if I asked you right now, what are the three rules for real estate?
Location, location, location.
And the three rules for comedy are audience, audience, audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a particular audience, one that you deal with. How important is humor in the classroom?
Well, it is important, and it's really important. It's, as I said to you, philosophy and joke telling, or jokes themselves, have something in common. They're trying to pursue or attack or look at a difficult situation. And I think philosophy tries to answer the unanswerable, the irresolvable, the unavoidable questions of life. And I think comedy tries to defang these kinds of issues. That is, give us pause. Let us look at it in a different way. In fact, I think Nietzsche was right when he said, and by the way, Friedrich Nietzsche was not a funny guy, no matter what anybody says.
No
matter what anybody says. He said we have art, but I want to insert humor there in order not to die of the truth. And so I think the same thing in a classroom. I think what we do in a classroom is, just like a stand-up comic, you got to remember, pay attention to your audience, and you can't be funny all the time, but I think a joke can detox a situation or make a situation clear. May I offer a suggestion?
Okay.
All right. Years and years ago, I used to teach. Now I teach only leadership and business ethics. That's a joke itself. We could deal with that some other time, perhaps, an oxymoron. But I was teaching being and time, Heidegger's Sein und Zeit, you know, what is the meaning of time and what is being inside of time? And this really amorphous concept. So here's a joke I regularly use. A woman who is seemingly very healthy goes to her regular physician for her annual checkup, and he says, Mary, I hate to tell you this. You've got this, after hours of examination, she's wondering what's going on here. You've got this terrible disease. In fact, it's so terrible, there's no cure for it. And frankly, I think you have less than 6 months to live, 6 months tops. She's shocked and says to him, but doctor, isn't there anything I could do, anything? And he says, yes, there is. And she said, what is it? What does it tell me? He says, I think you should rush right out and marry a tax accountant. He says, my God, will that cure me? He says, no, of course not. But it'll make the next 6 months seem like forever. Boom, bada, boom, bada, boom. The point is, time is fluid. Time registers differently. Time passes in different ways. And I think that joke helps. Your lack of humor, laughter suggests, perhaps it didn't work with you, but nevertheless, I think it's my attempt.
You teach ethics now. Talk about jokes in terms of ethics. Is there ethical and non-ethical humor?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there is a difference between an ethical joke and a non-ethical joke. But let me back up. I think an unethical joke, which we don't want to really register, but it seems counterintuitive, can be funny. I mean, there are horrible misogynistic jokes that are really funny. There are horrible racist jokes that linguistically are funny. They follow the rule. Ba-ba-da-boom, ba-ba-da-boom, pause, conclude, you know, punchline. There are anti-Semite jokes that are incredibly funny. Now, but the question is, should they be told? And I'm convinced, after thinking about this a very long time, that really a vicious, unethical joke does harm to the teller and the told and helps perpetuate the joke. That is, every time you tell, can I say this, and I don't mean this, a dumb blonde joke, you further perpetuate the notion of women aren't being smart, which is simply not true, right? But you do perpetuate the myth. And so I think that there's some, you know, and when you tell an anti-Semitic joke, you perpetuate the myth that they are Untermenschen, lower human beings, right? And so I think you have to be very careful. Now, unfortunately, if you're a card-carrying Nazi in 1939 in Berlin with and a comic in a nightclub with an audience full of Nazis, you're going to get lots of laughs. And, of course, that'll work there. But just because people laugh at something doesn't make it right. And it's a very difficult thing. It goes back to my other comment. We give comics license to explore, to push the envelope. But how far should they explore?
Still to come, our conversation with Al Jeaney continues with a look at the current and perhaps the future state of humor. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Al Jeaney, a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University in Chicago and a commentator on WGN Tribune Radio. We're talking about his new book, The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. And I asked about the current state of humor in the U.S. and what we may have to look forward to.
Right now, I think humor is at its, we're in the golden age because of a number of things, starting with Saturday Night Live 40-plus years ago, making humor, and don't forget, Saturday Night Live, although it just won an award for the best humorous two best humorous presentations, and one of them being Alec Baldwin's, a comic presentation of the president. Saturday Night Live is really a popular cultural show. It's always had political humor from the very beginning when Gerald Ford was president, Chevy Chase, imitated him. So there's been a male comic for every president all the way through. But it is a popular popular cultural show. Bill Maher, I think Jon Stewart, the internet and social media have changed comedy. And they makes it common, makes it available. And I think it's changed comedy from just telling jokes. Bob Hope getting up or Henny Youngman getting up and say, the secret to a happy marriage, simple. Dinner and dancing two nights a week. I go on Tuesday, she goes on Thursday. Boom, bada boom, right?
Exactly.
Bob Hope telling a political joke, but a very tame political joke. Met the president last week. He took me golfing. My biggest problem is, should I lose to him because he's a president or should I win because he's a lousy golfer? Ha, 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 right?
Exactly.
That kind of stuff. Very tame stuff. But with Bill Maher and Stewart, gloves are off. And I think also we're in a very, you may have noticed this politically and socially, a very contested time with lots of issues on the table. And so I think our comics are even more important to us. I think comics release tension. I think comics offer us relief. I think comics sometimes offer us a little bit of insight, i.e. John Oliver. Okay? And remember the people that Stewart has created out of that show, starting on Comedy Central.
Oh, look at the tree that came out of that show. It was amazing.
Huge. And the tree that comes out of Second City. And they're not doing sketches anymore. They're doing stand-up and acting kind of things. So I think that our comics, we're going back to the notion of public jester. I think we need our comics more. Interesting in doing the research for this book, my grandson really got interested in comedy, and he took some lessons at Second City and now wants to be a stand-up comic. And when we see each other, we share jokes, and very carefully share jokes. But my son is getting a little worried, and so am I. So I said, don't worry, son. My next book is The Virtue of Going to Medical School. And, maybe he'll be more interested in that somewhere down the line. But I do think it's very popular. Look at the number of clubs in America now, both franchise clubs and independent clubs. These are not nightclubs with dinner and dancing. No. These are $20 admission, 2 drink minimum, and 3 comics, right? And make sure you tip your waiter. So I think we need it more than ever before.
You did do the search for the perfect joke. Well, you didn't, but you reported on the search for the perfect joke. It's not quite that perfect, is it?
It's not that perfect, but it doesn't really offend anybody. But it can offend somebody if you make it ethnic. You know, if you put some name in there that you don't like. But yeah, the perfect joke is very quickly. I hope I don't ruin it. It's bad enough. I don't want to ruin it. Two gentlemen are out hunting in the forest one day, and suddenly his friend, one of them, grabs his chest and falls over keels to the ground, seemingly with a heart attack and as blue as can be. And the friend panics and goes to him and tries to give him CPR, but opens his phone and he calls up 911 and says, "I think my friend's had a heart attack. I think he may be dead." And very calmly the voice says, "Now stay calm. First thing we have to determine, is he dead?" He says, "Hang on." He puts the phone down. There's a shot. He picks up the phone. "Okay, now what?" Now, I don't think that's the funniest joke in the world,
no.
But everybody can relate to it. You know, there's something to it. Now, if you put an ethnic name in front of it, it becomes perhaps not an acceptable joke. See, think how easy jokes go from being funny to not funny. Can I give you another example of that?
Go ahead.
And there's this wonderful story at the Tip Top Club at the Empire State Building, the 99th floor, and two guys are at the bar, pretty sloshed. The one guy says, the other guy says, "You know, there's an airstrip, this airstream around this building. If you open that window over there and jump out, it'll shoot you around the building and you'll land right back in the room." The other guy says, "That's not possible." I says, "I'll bet you $200. The guy says, "Okay." Puts down his $200. The gentleman downs his beer, opens the window, jumps out, boom, flies all the way around, jumps back, goes back in the window, sits down the bar and says, "How about that?" He says, "Hey, that was great. I'm going to try it." Runs to the window, jumps out, and falls 99 floors to his death. The other gentleman sits at the bar, smirks, finishes his beer, and the bartender comes up and says, "You know, Superman, you're a real jerk when you drink too much." Now, you would think that's a non-offensive joke, right?
Sure.
Superman isn't real. It's clearly not possible. And yet there was pushback from Al-Anon people, from recovery people, addiction organizations, Alcoholics Anonymous saying, "You don't know the pain of being an alcoholic. You don't know what, you know, terrible." So I think every joke runs the risk of goring somebody's ox. And I think you have to be very, very careful what you say and when you say it. Again, my yardstick is, would you tell your mother a really dirty joke? And my other yardstick is my grandson. You know, I tell him really simple jokes like, what did the grape say after the rhinoceros stepped on it? And he says, "I don't know." And the answer is, "Not much. He just let out a little whine." And then he told me a naughty joke. And I said, no, son, you can't do that. "But you're grandpa. You're cool." "I know I'm cool, but you can't tell me that yet. You could tell your friends that, but you can't tell me that." And learning all these rules, comedy has rules. And I think it could free us. It could liberate us. It could also hurt us badly.
Well, that just goes back to audience, audience, audience again.
Yeah. Right
there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so you went from being lazy to being funny. I guess next is medical school.
The importance of medical school. That's right. This book is a follow-up on my book, The Importance of Being Lazy. And that lazy was kind of creative lazy. And I think comedy is creative as well. By the way, think about it. Some of the comics we really like John Oliver, these people are really intelligent, like Lewis Black, like Samantha Bee. These people are incredible. I mean, yes, the comic wit is there, but you know, to create that joke, the structure of that joke, to put together these things is amazing. I remember seeing Mort Saul, who's still alive at 92 and performing at least once a week, who was kind of this first person to really tell serious jokes. They're not jokes anymore. He was commenting on a political situation. And he was funny without being funny, you know, but there was still a punchline to it. There was still, he was saying something about the political scene. That was the beginning, and I think that Jon Stewart and certainly George Carlin, all those people really added to this and polished this thing. So now you have these fake news shows, and I think I want to yell about that a little bit. It's not fake news. It's funny commentary. It's real news. They're making fun of it.
So let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Jokes, why are they important?
Well, you know, we live in a community, all of us do, and part of living in a community is to learn habits and behaviors that are acceptable to other members of the community, to make life a little more bearable, to make life a little more doable. And I think one of the things good habits we could cultivate is humor. Now, we all dread the person who always enters, you know, the buffoon who comes in telling jokes, yuck, 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 jokes that are inappropriate, so on and so forth. That's why I call him buffoon. But I think humor is reaching out to someone, giving you a gift. And I started this book because of my Uncle Joe. My Uncle Joe, until the week before he died, every time he saw me from the time I was a little boy, I think it was my first communion, just before he kissed me, he would whisper in my ear a joke. And he always made me laugh. Somewhere in my teenage years, I rebelled at this. I said, what is this about, Uncle Joe? This is all in Italian, by the way. And he pulled away and he said, stupido, it's because I love you. If I didn't love you, why would I want to make you laugh? I'm giving you the gift of humor. Be careful how you use it. But if you love somebody, share it with them. That's why I think it's important to tell a joke.
Again, the name of Al Jeaney's new book is The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Can the hours you keep affect the decisions you make? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Early bird or night owl? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Krista Ingram, associate professor of biology at Colgate University, examines how when you go to sleep or wake up can affect your decision-making process throughout the day.
When asked about their sleep patterns, many people will either classify themselves as an early bird or a night owl. But did you know that your biological predisposition to either could have an influence on your decision-making throughout the day? A recent study my collaborators and I conducted explored how oscillations in our circadian clock genes, which influence our sleep-wake cycles, could impact how we make decisions. The study included 139 participants who were split into groups or chronotypes based on a survey that helps gauge preference for morning or evening hours. Participants were then given a risk-taking test and an ethics test. The risk assessment is known as the balloon analog risk task. In each round, participants could earn money for pumping up a virtual balloon, but they would lose all of the money from the round if the balloon bursts before taking payout. The ethics test challenged participants to match and add numbers in a time trial, with payments earned for each successful match. Our results showed that RNA-determined night owls are more than 3 times as likely to cheat on the matching test in the morning compared to their early bird peers, while early birds are more likely to cheat at night. When it comes to risky decisions and the balloon test, early birds are far more likely to push the envelope in the afternoon, while night owls show no difference in risk-taking with time of day, and are more risk-averse than early birds overall. So what does all this mean? If your clock genes cycle early as a morning person, you are more likely to make unethical or risky decisions in the afternoon, while the same can be said about a night owl making unethical decisions in the morning. Just imagine a judge or investment banker who are early birds making their decisions in the late afternoon. It just might behoove you to see them earlier.
That was Krista Ingram of Colgate University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.